Kevin wished his first visit to the two-dimensional town of Polaroidsville had also been his last visit there, but that was not the case. During the 13 nights since the first one, he'd had the dream more and more often. If the dumb dream happened to take the night off, little vacation, Kev, but see you soon, okay? He was apt to have it twice the next night. Now he always knew it was a dream, and as soon as it started, he would tell himself that all he had to do was wake himself up. Damn it, just wake yourself up. Sometimes he did wake up, and sometimes the dream just faded back into deeper sleep, but he never succeeded in waking himself up. It was always Polaroidsville now, never Oatley or Hildesville, those first two efforts of his fumbling mind to identify the place. And like the photograph, each dream took the action just a little bit further. First, the man with the shopping cart, which was never empty now even to start with, but filled with a jumble of objects, mostly clocks, but all from the Emporium Galorium, and all with the eerie look, not of real things, but rather photographs of real things, which had been cut out of magazines and then somehow, impossibly, paradoxically, stuffed into a shopping cart, which, since it was two-dimensional as the objects themselves, had no breadth in which to store them. Yet there they were, and the old man hunched protectively over them and told Kevin to get out, that he was a flushing thief. Only now, he also told Kevin that if he didn't get out,
"I'll sit Pop's dog on you, see if I don't."
The fat woman, who couldn't be fat since she was perfectly flat, but who was fat anyway, came next. She appeared pushing her own shopping cart, filled with Polaroid Sun cameras. She also spoke to him before he passed her.
"Be careful, boy," she'd say in the loud but toneless voice of one who was utterly deaf. "Pop's dog broke his leash, and he's a mean un. He tore up three or four people at the Trenton Farm in Camberville before he came here. It's hard to take his picture, but you can't do it at all unless you have a camera."
She would bend to get one, would sometimes get as far as holding it out. He would reach for the camera, not knowing why the woman would think he should take the dog's picture, or why he'd want to, or maybe he was just trying to be polite. Either way, it made no difference. They both moved with the stately slowness of underwater swimmers, as dream people so often do, and they always just missed making connections. When Kevin thought of this part of the dream, he always thought of the famous picture of God and Adam which Michelangelo had painted on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, each of them with an arm outstretched, and each with the hand at the end of the arm also outstretched, and the forefingers almost, not quite, but almost touching. Then she would disappear for a moment, because she had no width, and when she reappeared again, she was out of reach. "Well, just go back to her then," Kevin would think each time the dream reached this point. But he couldn't. His feet carried him heedlessly and serenely onward to the peeling white picket fence and Pop and the dog. Only the dog was no longer a dog, but some horrible mixed thing that gave off heat and smoke like a dragon and had the teeth and twisted, scarred snout of a wild pig. Pop and the sun dog would turn toward him at the same time, and Pop would have the camera. His camera, Kevin knew, because there was a piece chipped out of the side, up to his right eye. His left eye was squinted shut. His rimless spectacles glinted on top of his head in hazy sunlight. Pop and the sun dog had all three dimensions. They were the only things in this seedy, creepy little dream town that did.
"He's the one!" Pop cried in a shrill, fearful voice. "He's the thief! Sick him, boy! Pull his fucking guts out, is what I mean to say!"
And as he screamed out this last, heatless lightning flashed in the day as Pop triggered the shutter and the flash, and Kevin turned to run. The dream had stopped here the second time he had had it. Now, on each subsequent occasion, things went a little further. Again, he was moving with the aquatic slowness of a performer in an underwater ballet. He felt that if he had been outside himself, he would even have looked like a dancer, his arms turning like the blades of a propeller just starting up, his shirt twisting with his body, pulling taut across his chest and his belly at the same time he heard the shirt's tail pulling free of his pants at the small of his back with a magnified rasp like sandpaper. Then he was running back the way he came, each foot rising slowly, and then floating, dreamily. Of course dreamily, what else, you fool, he would think at this point every time. back down until it hit the cracked and listless cement of the sidewalk, the soles of his tennis shoes flattening as they took his weight and stanking up small clouds of grit, moving so slowly that he could see the individual particles revolving like atoms. He ran slowly. Yes, of course. And the sundog, nameless stray grendel of a thing that came from nowhere and signified nothing, and had all the sense of a cyclone, but existed nevertheless, chased him slowly, but not quite as slowly. On the third night, the dream faded into normal sleep, just as Kevin began to turn his head in that dragging, maddening, slow motion to see how much of the lead he had on the dog. It then skipped a night. On the following night, it returned twice. In the first dream, he got his head halfway around, so he could see the street on his left disappearing into limbo behind him as he ran along it. In the second, and from this one his alarm clock woke him, sweating lightly in a crouched, fetal position on the far side of the bed, he got his head turned enough to see the dog just as its forepaws came down in his own tracks. And he saw the paws were digging crumbly little craters in the cement because they had sprouted claws. And from the back of each lower leg joint, there protruded a long thorn of a bone that looked like a spur. The thing's muddy, reddish eye was locked on Kevin. Dim fire blew and dripped from its nostrils.
Jesus Christ, it snots on fire, Kevin thought.
And when he awoke, he was horrified to hear himself whispering it over and over, very rapidly.
Snots on fire, snots on fire, snots on fire.
Night by night, the dog gained on him as he fled down the sidewalk. Even when he wasn't turning to look, he could hear the sundog gaining. He was aware of a spread of warmth from his crotch, and he knew he was in enough fear to have wet himself, although the emotion came through in the same diluted, numbed way he seemed to have to move in this world. He could hear the sundog's paws striking the cement, could hear the dry crack and squall of the cement breaking. He could hear the hot blurts of its breath, the suck of air flowing in past those outrageous teeth. And on the night Pop woke up to find he had not only walked in his sleep, but taken at least one picture of it, Kevin felt as well as heard the sundog's breath for the first time, a warm rush of air on his buttocks, like the sultry suck of wind a subway on an express run pulls through a station where it needn't stop. He knew the dog was close enough to spring on his back now, and that would come next. He would feel one more breath. This one, not just warm, but hot as acute indigestion in your throat. And then that crooked, living bear trap of a mouth would sink deep into the flesh of his back, between the shoulder blades, ripping the skin and meat off his spine. And did he think this was really just a dream? Did he? He awoke from this last one, just as Pop was gaining the top of the stairs to his apartment and resting one final time before going inside back to bed. This time Kevin woke sitting bolt upright, the sheet and blanket which had been over him puddled around his waist, his skin covered with sweat, and yet freezing, a million little white goose pimples standing out all over his belly, chest, back, and arms like stigmata. Even his cheeks seemed to crawl with them. And what he thought about was not the dream, or at least not directly. He thought instead, it's wrong. The number is wrong. It says 3. But it can't. Then he flopped back, and in the way of children, for even at 15 most of him was still a child, and would be until later that day, he fell into a deep sleep again. The alarm woke him at 7:30, as it always did on school mornings, and he found himself sitting up in bed again, wide-eyed, every piece suddenly in place. The sun he had smashed hadn't been his sun. And that was why he kept having this same crazy dream over and over again. Pop Merrill, that kindly old Cracker Barrel philosopher and repairer of cameras and clocks and small appliances, had euchred him and his father as neatly and competently as a riverboat gambler does the tenderfeet in an old Western movie. His father! He heard the door downstairs slam shut and leaped out of bed. He took 2 running strides toward the door in his underwear, thought better of it, turned, yanked the window up and hollered, "Dad!" just as his father was folding himself into the car to go to work.